You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine joins us to give us the latest news from the science world, including a brand new giant dinosaur discovery. First, Wisconsin holds a special place in U.S. circus history.
In 1882, there were 33 circuses touring America. In 1884, there were almost 50. Among the newcomers were five brothers living in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Al, Otto, Alf T., Charles, and John Ringling had seen their first circus in Iowa as children. They had scrambled out of the house before dawn to meet a steamboat carrying a traveling show up the Mississippi River.
That's part of a new four-hour, two-part American Experience documentary titled The Circus. It premieres tonight on Wisconsin Public Television and Milwaukee Public Television at 8 p.m. One of the experts interviewed in the documentary is Wisconsinite Fred Dollinger Jr. He's a curator of circus history with the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art in Sarasota, Florida. He's been studying the circus for 50 years. Fred, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I want to talk about that excitement in the 1800s of hearing that the circus is coming to town in an age without the internet or TV or college football. Can you talk about what that felt like?
Well, Circus Day was one of the three big days of the year for children in particular. It ranked right up there with the 4th of July and with Christmas. It was a day when life wasn't lived as normal. You maybe got loose from your chores. You could go watch the circus arrive in town, see the parade, and then go to the showgrounds to witness a performance. And when you read the remarks about it by people like Hamlin Garland, it was just like a day like no other day.
Well, I want to bring it home to Wisconsin. You're joining us from Baraboo right now. Tell us how the Ringling brothers got into the circus game.
Well, it just happened that their family was living here in Baraboo, and they came into exposure with other people who were showmen. And in the late 1870s, John and Al, the oldest of them, went into the employ of a fellow named Dr. Morrison in Delavan, Wisconsin. And they just prospered and grew this idea of owning their own show. And in 1882, they started with a very modest hall show that played the opera houses around this area. And then in 1884, by their own ability, they put together some wagons, a tent, seating, and they took out their very first modest circus. And really, there was more to be seen from their own hand than from the other performers that they hired, but people really recognized right away that these guys had determination, they had skill, and above all, they had dedication to making sure that all of their customers had a good experience at their circus.
What did it take to put together a show in an industry kind of defined by this amazing showman slash flim-flam man in some ways, P.T. Barnum?
Well, you could start out in a very modest way, which is what the Ringlings did. They probably have no more than about a half dozen wagons and maybe 6 to 10 horses, maybe less capital than $1,000 invested. But because you could actually perform, manage, administer, and do all the things required to operate a circus, it really didn't take a whole lot beyond your own dedication to the task. So, yes, it was very modest as compared to the industry leader Barnum Bailey, but the thing to remember that between 1884 when they started and the late 1890s, let's say 1897, the Ringling brothers grew their circus at a rate that was unprecedented in history. They literally were the equal of the great Barnum Bailey show 13 years after starting on the road.
Now, I understand that there was a lot of negative reaction to the circus. People thought it was immoral or amoral. It was a bad influence, especially on those kids you were talking about. Talk about that response.
Well, that's kind of a funny question because adults would make excuses of they were going to see the circus because they wanted their children to see it. And you do hear a lot of comments from the pulpit that are anti-circus. It is generally in regard to the lack of female coverage of the flesh, but yet it was very popular. I think in some ways the circus came into town and was somewhat exempt from local cultural mores in a sense that they did allow women to have a little bit less clothing than they'd see in the street because, quite frankly, if you had long skirts and other parts of the typical wardrobe, you couldn't have danced upon the back of a horse or done acrobatics on the ground or in the air. So I think there was something of an exception to the normal wardrobe that was expected for women, despite the comment from the pulpit.
we ended up with this big merger, the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. How did we end up with three and then two powerhouse circus companies ending up as one?
Well, that took place in the fall of 1918 when the declining number of brothers realized that America could no longer support two super big, gigantic circuses. Both the Ringling Show and the Barnum & Bailey Show were touring on 80 railroad cars. Each required four trains with two locomotives, a caboose and the crews for each one. And at the time, we were also enduring the Spanish flu. We're at the tail end of World War One, and kind of everything came together and said, it's time to reduce the operations. So they took their two 80-car troops and created eventually one 100-car wow. railroad circus, which was the Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey, the greatest show on earth.
What led to the decline of the popularity of circuses? Was it just, as I kind of hinted at earlier, the rise in other ways we can entertain ourselves?
I think that's a principal reason. At the turn of the century, you started to see amusement parks, Nickelodeon theaters, traveling carnivals, greater agricultural fairs. Then in the 1920s, you got the motion picture palaces, which had a great feature, air conditioning. So instead of people going and sitting in a hot, sultry circus tent, they could go into an air-conditioned space and spend time there. In the 1950s, television had a huge impact on traveling shows, and all forms of outdoor entertainment really took a hit as television peripherally around the country.
There are still circuses that tour the country. Do you go to watch them yourselves? Do they keep that tradition alive?
Well, it's something that I would hope that all people keep alive. There are still a few troops that travel around itinerantly by motor highway using truck and trailers. They no longer use canvas tents. They use vinyl tents because they're more enduring. But they do erect the top and go through the same traditional events that characterize circus days of the past. They're just not as grandiose as they once were.
Now, we've got this whole documentary answering this question for us, but as we start to wrap up, can you tell us why it's important to look back at the circus as this unique part of American history?
I think the circus both reflected us and our culture, and it also influenced our culture. It introduced things like electric lights, early forms of film, and other types of technology to our people. It also brought forth ethnological congresses that educated us about people and cultures around the world. But it also showed some of the things that maybe aren't the best about our culture, such as segregation. The seating under the big top was segregated. So it serves as kind of a vehicle of both education and reflection. Today, we don't think about the circus, but many of the things that once made it unusual are part of our culture today. If you think in terms of how many people have tattoos today, you don't have to go to the circus to see a tattooed person. And the young man across the street might have put a ramp up on his roof to ride his skateboard off the roof. These are the kind of things that you'd go to the circus in the past, but today, the circus is kind of directly infused into our culture, and we just don't think about it that way. But it really has been there a long time.
We'll leave it there. Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Rob.
Wisconsinite Fred Dollinger Jr. is a curator of circus history with the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art in Sarasota, Florida. The new four-hour, two-part American Experience documentary titled The Circus premieres tonight on Wisconsin Public Television and Milwaukee Public Television at 8 p.m. First, it's time for our monthly check-in on the most intriguing stories from the science world. Today, quantum theory may not be at the top of your mind day-to-day, but it actually allows us to wake up and smell the coffee, among other things. We'll get very small with bacteria and viruses, and really big with a newly discovered giant dinosaur. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and happy science.
Well, and happy science to you. And let's start off with, I don't know, the most sciencey of science, quantum theory, or the weirdest of science, anyway. It's weird. When I try to read about it and understand it, it freaks me out. But an article in Discover says it's actually part of our day-to-day lives, maybe of how our senses operate. Weird? How so?
Yeah, and you know, the crazy thing is, I think when you say quantum mechanics to most people, they go, oh gosh, this is going to make me feel dumb. But we actually, the story in our current issue, it's really great at bringing home drinking your morning coffee is an act of quantum mechanics, okay? And let's start with, you know, let's say your significant other actually brews the coffee for you while you're in bed. So you're laying in bed, not quite awake, and then you smell that wonderful, rich aroma of your medicine. I mean coffee. And for some of us, it is medicinal, myself included. And
guilty.
Basically what's happening, the coffee molecules are wafting up to you and getting into your nose and leading your brain to register, coffee. But the question is, how do those molecules get from that delicious cup of coffee downstairs all the way to your upstairs bedroom, up your nose, and into your brain? And researchers think that is a quantum mechanics issue. So basically, to unpack it as quickly as I can, you've got these molecules, these coffee molecules, that are a specific shape. And it was long thought that they binded to specific receptors, like a lock and key, in your olfactory sense, in your sense of smell. And that somehow that got translated in your brain, from your nose to your brain, as, freshly ground coffee waiting for me. But now, people who study quantum mechanics are thinking that it's not just the shape of the molecules, it's how they vibrate. Because molecules are actually vibrating all the time. They're just jiggly little things, right? And it's actually the little specific dance they do that tells your brain, oh, coffee. So this is just one of a zillion examples of how you're experiencing quantum mechanics on a daily basis.
Yeah, and this piece gets into sight and touch. I'll leave those for the article, but one weird thought I want to leave quantum mechanics on before we move on. The idea that our senses intentionally disguise how complex the universe is, so we can't see the individual photons because our puny brains couldn't process it all if we got all that information.
You can't handle the truth.
Exactly.
That's exactly it. And basically, you know, they've done tests where can an organism gauge, say, the exact amount of water in a pool? And no, but you can gauge how much water you will allow you to survive. In other words, you know, if the water's too high, you're going to drown. So you can gauge things that are directly relevant to you as an individual surviving. And that's basically physicists think how we process reality. So we're not really processing reality. We're processing the version that, like you said, our tiny little brains can handle. So my tiny brain just blew up with that knowledge. But yeah, it's a really cool story.
Well, I'll pick my brain up off the floor now and move on to something that you wrote about, Gemma. This is amazing. Trying to find the DNA of viruses and bacteria to trace the evolution of diseases. And this is something up till like literally months ago, we didn't know if we could do.
Yeah, and you know, there's been a little work done. Like, I think most people are probably familiar with the genetic history of the plague pathogen actually being decoded, so now we understand a little bit better how great plague events such as the Black Death occurred. And when I say great, I mean huge, not great like woo.
Woo. So, yeah, no.
Yeah, but since then, two things have happened in the field of paleopathology and the folks who, the molecular biologists, who try to figure out the backstory of pathogens. And two big things have happened just in the last few months. One of them, we have this flood of ancient DNA from humans that is actually being put in open access databases that any of these scientists can go and use, which is a great, great thing. So we've gotten better at extracting and sequencing ancient DNA. It's now more widely available, so scientists from all over the world can access the actual genomes and data. And there's one more very important piece of the puzzle, and that is an explosion in these new software programs that can basically, I mean, not to bring up quantum mechanics again, but they process so much information, it again makes your tiny brain explode. And so they're able to process data that would have been impossible to process even, say, a year or two ago, just because they're able to handle such huge data sets and do them very quickly, often in a matter of hours.
And so now we're able to go back, I don't know how far, and look at viruses and bacteria that we couldn't look at, you know, the ancestors of today's viruses and bacteria, and look at their DNA before.
Right. Well, for example, again, just a year or so ago, having a 300-year-old sample of, say, hepatitis B was a big deal. Oh, that was great. You know, it was 300 years old. We can learn something about the past of this particular virus. Well, in May, a study came out, and they were able to sequence genomes from several truly ancient hepatitis B virus samples, including one that was 4,500 years old. And I had an interview scheduled with the authors, and then all of a sudden another paper came out that sequenced a 7,000-year-old strain of hepatitis B. So, you know, day by day, they're pushing the time clock back further and further in terms of what they can see in these ancient pathogen genomes. So by the time we finish this interview, there'll probably be an older one out there.
Right. This is super interesting in and of itself. And it sounds like this could help us with the diseases of today, because it's useful to know how these things mutate, how quickly they evolve over generations. This could be practical knowledge as well as interesting historical information.
Absolutely. This is huge for the study of potential epidemics and outbreaks for two reasons. Bacterium, very, very tricksy things that actually steal pieces of DNA from other organisms and incorporate them into their own genomes. So they're always evolving very quickly. And viruses have this crazy skill to kind of resurrect big chunks of their genetic past and basically become something that they might have been in the past, if that makes any sense. Kind of like one of the researchers I talked to equated it to an elephant suddenly having a woolly mammoth head. So viruses and bacteria are both really good at using bits and bobs of genes from themselves or other organisms to evolve very quickly. But by seeing what they were like in the past, we can get a much better version of what they might become in the future, a much better vision of it. And, you know, hopefully epidemiologists and others can plan for that, whether it be developing vaccines or early warning systems for epidemics. So it's really promising. It's not just a history exercise. It's very much future-focused on tomorrow's medicine.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at intriguing stories from the world of science. Still to come, superstition and a dinosaur. Let's start with superstition. Gemma, Packer fan superstitions failed this weekend. Brewer fan superstitions succeeded. There's a lot of research out there, it turns out, on kind of our life stages of superstition. What do we know?
Yeah, and I just have to say, as an aside, that I really wanted to watch the Brewers games the last few days. I intentionally didn't, because whenever I watch a Brewers game, they lose.
Well done.
So, I want you to know that I made the sacrifice for the team. I did listen on the radio, though, which is okay. It works on the radio. It's just if I actually watch it on TV, the Brewers lose. So, anyway, don't worry, guys. Not going to be watching the Brewers on TV for the foreseeable future, if ever. But, yeah, so that kind of thinking, I know, even as I'm saying it, that that's totally irrational, totally crazy, doesn't make sense, not real. Get over it, Gemma, right? But the truth is that there's this period in our childhood when we're about 4 or 5 until we're about 9. I dare say I call it the Santa Claus years. And that's when kids are going to assign kind of like magical thinking, or, oh, that happened, it was a miracle, or that happened because I did this, when there's no link whatsoever. So we kind of outgrow it, but not really, because I'm sure everybody has, you know, that thing that they do, whether it's knocking on wood or carrying a quote-unquote lucky charm when you're going for a job interview, slipping it in your pocket, you know. So we all do those things. And the question is, why do we do it? It's because we have two different ways of thinking. One is very intuitive, very fast, you jump to conclusions, and the other is slower and more deliberate. So the slower, more deliberate way we think knows it's irrational, that there is no connection between what I watch on TV and whether the Brewers win or lose. I know that. The slow, deliberate part of my brain knows that. But that fast, jump to conclusions part of my thinking is like, oh, better not turn on the TV if we want the Brewers to win, right? So basically, we develop this kind of dichotomy within our own heads about we know it's irrational, but we still knock on wood or do whatever we're going to do, because every time we knock on wood and nothing bad happens or we get the job or whatever, we're reinforcing our brain saying, oh, I knocked on wood and the Brewers won, or whatever scenario you want to go with. What we should do instead, if we want to overcome this magical thinking, is pay attention to those times we do watch the Brewers on TV, or we don't knock on wood, and we see that the, you know, bad outcome that we feared doesn't happen. And so by reinforcing when your lucky charm doesn't work, or, you know, when a black cat crosses your path and you get to work just fine anyway, that's how you can retrain your brain to get over its irrational side.
All right, I promise people dinosaurs. Gemma, I want to get to that before we wrap up. New discovery, let's see, Ledu Mahadi Mafubi. Is the name
Mahadi, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Is the name of this dinosaur. It's big. It's not the biggest, but it's a big deal. Tell us why.
Well, it was the biggest of its time, and that's back in the early Jurassic. You know, in the Cretaceous, which was after the Jurassic, all the dinosaurs you see in Jurassic Park, they were actually pretty much from the Cretaceous, but it's just really hard to say Cretaceous Park. So basically, you had the really giant, enormous, ridiculous-sized dinosaurs in the Cretaceous, but Ledu Mahadi is from the Jurassic, which came before it. So it's a much earlier dinosaur. And at the time, most of the dinosaurs running around were like the size of a mouse, maybe the size of a dog. They were not that impressive. Ledu Mahadi, if you can imagine it, was twice the size of an African elephant. So comparatively, it was big. In fact, the researchers think this was the biggest dinosaur of its time.
And maybe it set the stage for the development of those really big guys later on?
Actually, it challenges how we thought the really big guys developed later on, because researchers thought that the really big dinosaurs first developed this stance where their legs were like columns directly under them to support their weight, again, like a modern elephant. And what Ledu Mahadi shows us is that it was possible to get really big without that particular posture and without the particular anatomy that researchers thought was necessary to bear that much weight. Ledu Mahadi actually had very flexible limbs and was kind of, you know, walking around with kind of, I imagine it sauntering, you know, with its knees and elbows bending, kind of like, you know, sauntering down the street like, doop doop doop, I'm the biggest dinosaur. So, and that's exactly what all dinosaurs sound like, for real. But so actually the existence of this dinosaur, which was found in South Africa, and that makes it really exciting, that's a huge hotspot for paleontology right now, this dinosaur got as big as it did without the anatomical adaptations that paleontologists expect to find. So it actually challenges our ideas about just how big an animal can get.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Gemma Tarlak for the science and for the reenactment. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine. Now, over the last few weeks, allegations of sexual assault against the newly confirmed Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh have been the focus of the political world. And just like the initial Me Too movement last year, the story is starting conversations among families and friends about sexual assault and harassment. Our next guest has been writing about messages she's gotten from survivors explaining why they haven't shared their stories with family members, in particular with their fathers. Monica Hesse is an author and a columnist at The Washington Post. Her recent column is titled, "Dear Dads, Your Daughters Told Me About Their Assaults. This is Why They Never Told You." Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what got you started on this story, looking at a lot of people, apparently, who specifically avoided telling their fathers about assault and harassment?
Like a lot of journalists who have been covering the Kavanaugh trials or the Kavanaugh hearings or who had written about them, I was getting a lot of emails from people who wanted to share their stories. And one theme that kept coming up over and over again were people saying, "I'm telling you, but I haven't told my family." And specifically, "I'm telling you, but I can't tell my father." And it happened enough that I thought that that was really interesting and wanted to explore more why that was the case.
And you open your piece with an email from a dad, actually, who just recently found out a story from his daughter. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. A few weeks ago, I had written a column about street harassment. And this father wrote me and said, "This sounds awful. I'm so glad my daughter hasn't ever experienced anything like this." And his daughter was 19 or 20. She was in college. And then less than a day later, he wrote back and said, "I talked with my daughter about this. She told me that she's experienced harassment many, many times. She just usually didn't tell me about it because she didn't want me to be in pain. She didn't want me to know it had happened to her." And it was sort of an eye-opening, revelatory moment for him to realize that his daughter had been going through something and that she never talked with him about it before.
And your readers gave you different reasons why they didn't tell their dad in particular. But that was a really common theme, it sounds like, that so this young, usually woman, in some cases young man, had been through some kind of horrible experience and yet felt they needed to shelter their father from hearing it.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. There were plenty of people who wrote and said, I haven't told my father because I know he wouldn't believe me, and I don't feel like I can trust him. We don't have that relationship. Or even worse, people who said, I can't tell my father because my father was my attacker. He's the one who molested me. But the most common response that I received was, I can't tell my dad because I need to protect him, because I love him and he loves me, and I know that he would feel just devastated by the idea that this had happened to me.
Talking to Monica Hesse from The Washington Post, her recent column, Dear Dads, Your Daughters Told Me About Their Assaults. Here's Why They Never Told You. You also mentioned a moment on Fox News when Chris Wallace opened up about stories his own daughters had recently revealed to him. Here's a listen to part of that.
Over the course of this week, like I think a lot of American families, my family, a lot of it on email, has been discussing this and disagreeing and arguing about it. And two of my daughters have told me stories that I had never heard before about things that happened to them in high school and hadn't told their parents. I don't know if they told their friends, certainly had never reported it to police. They weren't as serious as the allegations against Kavanaugh. But the point is that there are teenage girls who don't tell stories to a lot of people, and then it comes up. And I don't think we can disregard that.
Do you feel like, Monica, from Me Too, with the Kavanaugh hearings, that maybe more families are having this conversation now where they might not have a year and a half ago?
Yeah, I think that the Kavanaugh hearings in particular were a real wake-up call to a lot of families because they were so polarizing and because so many people heard Dr. Ford's testimony and said things like, I just can't believe it, because I can't believe that she would have had that happen to her and not told her parents. And I think that those reactions are in turn causing a lot of women or other victims to say, but that's what I did, Dad. I didn't tell you about it. And it's causing, it's prompting a lot of discussions.
So what does it say to you about, the, I don't know, the dynamics of fatherhood? What dads do? How do they communicate about not just assault, but maybe about gender in general?
Well, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and this came up in email after email, were daughters who said, my dad, I know he loves me. He always told me if anyone tried to hurt me, he would kill them. And as young women, they took that really literally. They took that as, if I tell my dad about this, he will murder my attacker and then he'll go to prison and then it will be my fault. And so I think that there is, that fathers are now rethinking the way that they can be supportive and the way that they can be a comfort to their daughters. And maybe the sort of macho-filled, I'll kill anyone who touches my little girl, isn't always the best way to be supportive and isn't always the best way to have a dialogue. I also think that we need to have more open lines of dialogue in ways that relate to gender but don't relate to assault. An example that I brought up is the way that we talk about tampons or the way that we talk about periods, and how on sitcoms, a man having to go buy a pack of Kotex for his wife or a daughter is seen as this shameful, embarrassing, creepy experience. And I think that once we open lines of communication about a lot of different things, it'll also be easier for us to talk about assault.
Another theme that came up in from some of your readers, and also that we saw on the Why I Didn't Report hashtag on Twitter, was the thought that a father or anyone reported to might judge the survivor, the victim, for being in a situation that might put blame on them.
Yeah, and I think that comes up especially for women who have heard their dads or their brothers talk about survivors in general in a particular way. So if you've heard your dad say, well, she shouldn't have been wearing that, or she shouldn't have been at that party, or, you know, what did she expect with a skirt like that? You're going to be a lot more reticent to tell your dad about what happened to you, because you're going to wonder what judgments he's going to make about you. If he's going to immediately ask why you were at that party, or why you had a beer, or why you were wearing a short skirt, you're just going to feel like it's not worth it for him to have that perception of you.
We're talking to Washington Post columnist Monica Hesse about her column, Dear Dads, Your Daughters Told Me About Their Assaults. This is Why They Never Told You. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard a story about a harassment or even sexual assault in recent weeks and recent months from someone unexpected? Are you rethinking certain experiences in your own past? What kind of conversations has the Me Too movement, the hearings on these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh started within your family, in your group of friends? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Monica Hesse of the Washington Post about messages she got from women, mostly women, explaining why they'd kept their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault from their families, in particular from their fathers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound familiar to you? Is this an experience you've encountered in your own life, in your own family? What do you wish you'd heard from a father or any parent to make you feel more comfortable to talk about things like this? If you're a parent yourself, are you talking to your kids now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And Monica, you wrote in another column, but related to this, a lot of people thinking back on stories in their own lives and rethinking something that they might have dismissed earlier as maybe somebody who'd survived an incident or maybe somebody who had perpetrated one.
Yeah, I think that there are two ways to process through everything that we're talking about now and everything that we've had that we've experienced in our own lives. And one way is to say, this isn't that big a deal. It happened to me and I got over it. Or it's not that big a deal. It happened all the time when I was young. And I think that what would be helpful is for us to not ask what has been normal, but what should be normal. Just because these things happened to us when we were younger, do we want them to happen to younger people? Or do we want different generations to have higher expectations and to have more open conversations for what should happen between two young people?
Now, you write in your column, the one we started off talking about, and I'm quoting here, for all the stereotypes that linger about women being too fragile or emotional, these past weeks have revealed what many women already knew. A lot of effort goes into protecting men we love from bad things that happen to us. Can you talk a little more about that?
Sure. I mean, I think that that's the central point and the central truth of the column, that a lot of the information that came out in the Kavanaugh hearings, not in the hearings themselves, but because of the hearings, women sharing their stories of assault, women sharing their stories of bad sexual experiences in high school, those stories were not surprising to me, and they were not surprising to most women I know, because we have talked about these stories among ourselves for a really long time. You stay away from so-and-so when he's had too much to drink, he gets handsy. Or you be sure to text me when you get to the party. Be sure to text me when you're leaving the party. Be sure to text me if you need a ride home. This is a world that a lot of us have lived in for a really long time. But these stories were surprising to a lot of men because they don't live in that world, and because good guys don't realize that women have to live in that world. So I think that it's just been a really eye-opening experience for a lot of decent men who haven't maybe fully understood how prevalent these problems are.
A caller who wanted to remain anonymous and not have her voice on the air says she went through an experience where a priest attempted to assault her. She was able to fight him off. She said because he was well-known, people said that it was her fault. She says the Me Too movement really has brought back those memories for her. This is another common theme in the Why I Didn't Report, and this came up in your column too, people who did bring stories to someone else, and because it was a prominent person or a trusted person, they weren't believed.
Sure, and I think that I mean, obviously, she mentions being assaulted by a priest. The scandal in the Catholic Church goes back decades. And for a long time, accusers were afraid that they wouldn't be believed just because of the prominent role that their abusers had. And so I think that is something that we're also grappling with and learning, that just because someone presents a trustworthy face or has a prominent role in the community doesn't mean that they're innocent. It just means that their prominent role might have made it easier for them to keep victims silent.
Thanks to that caller. Monica, as you hear from a lot of people of various generations, it sounds like, do you get a sense that, okay, we're talking about this now, but it's going to fade? Or do you get a sense that people are saying, okay, we need to do things better for the next generation?
I really hope that it's the latter. I think that what's happening now is that everything is coming to the surface at once. And that means stories that have been buried for 1 year and stories that have been buried for 30 years. The sense that I get is that women have been approaching their tales of assault for the same way since 1950, coming up to 2017. So I think that there's going to be a period of time where we unearth a lot of stuff, and that's going to be really painful. Unearthing that stuff is going to be really, really painful. But I hope that when we're done, we will be better as a society. We'll be having better kinds of conversations.
One thing that didn't come up in your column, I've seen some people talking about going back to when the alleged assaults by Brett Kavanaugh happened, the early 1980s. People have been looking at the pop culture of the time. A lot of movies, the 16 Candles and a lot of other movies, kind of treating assault as kind of a comic element. Do you see that changing in the way in pop culture we approach these issues?
I do. I mean, you mentioned 16 Candles, and the scene that I immediately think back to and cringe is the scene where a girl is very drunk at a party, and the man who is supposed to be our hero, the male dreamboat of the story, kind of gifts her to a younger boy. He kind of says, "I don't want to deal with her. You take her and do whatever you want." And it's played for laughs because the younger boy is geeky and, oh, ha ha, isn't it funny that she's going to end up, that this cheerleader is going to end up sleeping with a skinny dork. And now everything about that scene is horrifying. But I think of that scene because I think that it was made, and whenever it was made, 1986, maybe it wouldn't have been horrifying in 1987. Maybe it wouldn't have been horrifying in 1988. Maybe by 1996, we would have been looking at it a little cockeyed. And now by 2018, it's fully scary. So I think that looking back at pop culture moments is a way of measuring our progress, is a way of saying, this wouldn't fly now. We must have gotten better because we wouldn't allow this to be made now.
Monica, in our last few moments, you've heard a lot of these stories from readers. A lot of them are out there. Are you, just being in this fire hose of these difficult stories, filled more with dread to see how bad things have been, or hope that people are starting to talk about it now?
I wouldn't say dread or hope, but I think that there's a massive unburdening that's happening. And I think that's the beginning of hope. There's a massive, almost every email that I receive begins with, "I haven't told this to anyone, but I think I'll feel better if I share it." And right now they're sharing it with me, an anonymous person whom they've never met before. But I hope some of them are gaining the strength to share it with people that they know. And I hope when they share it with those people that their loved ones will treat those confessions with respect, and they can all start healing together.
Monica, thanks for joining us today. That was Monica Hesse, columnist for The Washington Post. Republicans in Wisconsin's 1st congressional district are fighting hard to hold on to the seat House Speaker Paul Ryan has held for nearly two decades. As Laurel White reports, a former Ryan staffer is facing off in the race against a Democrat who's hoping to harness party enthusiasm to flip the seat.
Last year, millions of dollars started flowing into Wisconsin from all over the country with one purpose: defeat Paul Ryan in 2018. The money mostly went to Democrat Randy Brice, an iron worker and union activist who had run and lost previous elections for state and local offices. But Brice clearly struck a chord this time with his campaign announcement video released in June 2017.
I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Brice's ad went viral. He got millions of dollars in out-of-state campaign contributions and the endorsement of Senator Bernie Sanders, who won Wisconsin's Democratic presidential primary in 2016. But almost a year later, the narrative changed when Paul Ryan dropped out of the race.
What I realize is, if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
Republicans chose Brian Stile, an attorney and member of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, as their party's nominee for the seat. In an early campaign ad, Stile introduced himself as a conservative outsider who could bring Wisconsin-style politics to Washington.
Because I was raised right here in Janesville on Southeast Wisconsin-style values, I don't care much for Washington-style politics.
It's Stile's first campaign for office, but he's hardly a newcomer to GOP politics. He was once a staffer for Ryan and was a delegate at the Republican National Convention in 2016. Stile and his allies have tried to frame the race around Brice's background. Republican groups have run ads pointing out that Brice has been arrested 9 times for crimes including drunk driving and property damage. Joe Zepecki is a Democratic strategist who's worked on a number of campaigns in Wisconsin. He says Brice has responded well to those attacks.
He's put it out there and said, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. You know what? We've got enough people with Ivy League credentials and who have never gotten in trouble in their whole life in Congress, and look where it's gotten us.
Not everyone agrees. Randy Brice's own brother, James Brice, supports Stile and even cut a TV ad on his behalf. Mark Grawl is a Republican strategist who's worked on statewide campaigns. He acknowledges Republicans are facing headwinds in the 2018 election, but says Stile has run a strong race in a GOP district.
I mean, I think he fits the district well. His background in manufacturing, I think, is a real positive right now. I think his work in the community with his family is something that is also a real positive, and I think a big contrast with Randy Brice.
Brice is trying to draw his own contrasts, comparing Stile's work as a corporate attorney to his own blue-collar background.
It's not about who's the more perfect person to represent you. It's about who understands the hardships that you're going to face in order to make your world a better place.
When it comes to issues, the two follow partisan divides seen elsewhere this election cycle. Brice supports Medicare for All and the Affordable Care Act's protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Stile says more price transparency and increased use of health savings accounts would make the healthcare system better. The race doesn't have the national profile it once did, but millions of dollars are still being spent here. As Stile fights to hold on to a GOP district, and Brice tries to harness Democratic enthusiasm to flip it. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.